Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Poland accuses Belarus of exploiting migrants as thousands flock to the country. We look at the situation on the ground and tense language on both sides. Plus,
it was great because I was glad to get COVID vaccinated.
As vaccination for kids in the U.S. ramps up, Europe once again becomes the epicenter of the pandemic. Dr. Paul Offit on the trajectory of the virus and his new book, You Bet Your Life. Then,
I just want everyone to know that people who lost their lives shouldn't have lost their lives in this festival.
A desperate search for answers in the wake of the Astroworld Festival tragedy. We look at how it happened, who is responsible, and how to prevent it ever happening again. And
OxyContin.
Purdue Pharma, they've been marketing the drug as something that's non-addictive, when it clearly is.
Dope Sick, the new series examining the worst drug epidemic in American history and the lives it destroyed. Hari Srinivasan speaks to actors Peter Sarsgaard and John Hogenacker.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christian Amanpour, who will be back tomorrow. Using people as pawns, a deliberate escalation of tensions, instrumentalizing migrants. Strong words from European leaders as Poland accuses Belarus of urging a, quote, mass entry of migrants across their shared borders. With thousands gathering at the frontier, tensions are escalating fast. Poland says thousands of additional military personnel have been deployed. The EU believes Belarus's Alexander Lukashenko is seeking revenge for sanctions. He denies manufacturing the crisis and is warning Poland against acting inhumanely towards the migrants. At the center of this war of words, thousands of desperate people in search of a better life. Joining me now, journalist Matthew Luxmore. He spent several days near the Poland-Belarus border. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us. We have been covering this heartbreaking story as it's developed and as obviously the winter months have come closer on the ground there. But can you give us a picture of what life is like for these migrants just basically trying to stay alive at this point?
Yeah, it's really a heartbreaking situation. Temperatures are plummeting in this part of Poland, in the east of the country. It's around -2 degrees Celsius at night at the moment. Many of these people who have managed to cross the border with help from Belarusian border guards, they're essentially enduring this weather and a serious lack of food and clothing. And sometimes they're helped by Polish activists who come into the forests and leave supplies that they later find. But a lot of people are really in dire straits. Some of them have been there for a very long time, evading Polish army and police patrols because they fear that they would be then pushed back into Belarus and have to start the whole journey all over again.
You profiled a Syrian family in your latest piece for Radio Free Europe, and I urge all of our viewers to read it. It's a really heartbreaking and gripping piece, but it gives us a sense of what just one family is going through. Their story, by the way, is a hopeful story at the end. Not all are experiencing that, unfortunately. But you profile a Syrian refugee, Rakis Rohr, who gained asylum in Germany 5 years ago and was trying to get his family, including his father, his wife, his sister, his uncle, his cousins, into the country, and they're stuck at the border. Can you talk about what he experienced and what his family members experienced?
I met Raki after he had been staying at a hotel in Hajnovka, a town near the border, for around 6 days already. He had tried so many different things to try and get his family out, trying to talk to Polish activists, trying to somehow maybe take them to a safe house in the town. And really, when I met him, he was very close to breaking point. He was very concerned. Temperatures were dropping rapidly. And in fact, the night I met him, we had had very heavy rainfall the previous day. So it was felt particularly cold that night. And he was just thinking of his family while he was sitting in a hotel, really kind of unable to do anything, because if he tried to lead them out of the forest, they could easily be caught by one of these Polish army patrols. I went into the woods with him, into the forest, to try and find his family. And we had to be very careful in avoiding Polish army patrols as well. This was actually a part of the border area that was legal to enter. Other parts are not, and journalists are also not allowed to enter an area that's around 3 kilometers away from the border zone on each side. And I saw him see his wife Safa for the first time in 5 days, and she was, I will never forget the look on her face. She was really in despair, and he whispered things to her ear. He decided not to share that with me, but I can't imagine what he said to her in that conversation. And the following day, I was witness to conversations about, you know, some perhaps, you know, efforts to, for them to make it out. I only learned after I'd left the border zone that they had made it out, and now they're safely in Germany. And this is the case for many migrants who have made this route. They don't see Poland as a final destination. They mainly see Germany as a place that they want to head to, because they see Germany as a much more welcoming country and a country that's much more likely to grant them asylum.
You talk about his father, who's 70 years old, and his brother, who had been mauled by dogs. I mean, just the inhumanity here is heartbreaking and devastating. It's lovely to see the pictures that you posted there and that we have of them during happier times. Fortunately, for those who don't understand the backstory, can you give us a sense of why we are here right now? How these migrants from Middle Eastern countries experiencing unrest are finding themselves in Eastern Europe, in Belarus of all places?
Sure. Well, only in the past few weeks has Belarus kind of emerged, I guess more accurately a couple of months, has Belarus really emerged as kind of the main route for many, many migrants to Europe. And I guess the story is fairly simple. Alexander Lukashenko, the authoritarian leader of Belarus, he won elections. He claimed a landslide win in elections last August. That sparked enormous protests in Belarus. And since then, there's really been kind of a standoff with the European Union and the US, which have slapped sanctions on his regime. And many see this as kind of his retaliation to those sanctions. He has essentially opened up borders to arrivals from many countries, including Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, who have paid, in some cases, thousands of dollars to Belarusian tour companies that are allegedly tied to the state to fly to Minsk, from where they have a prearranged transfer to the border with Belarus. And then Belarusian border guards, according to numerous accounts of migrants that I've spoken to, but also many I've seen shared by other journalists, Belarusian border guards cut the concertina wire and let select groups of migrants through into Poland. And then they're essentially on their own trying to make it into the forest where they kind of wait for a smuggler's signal. But this is definitely seen very much as a kind of geopolitical standoff, a way for Lukashenko to put major pressure on the European Union by essentially, I guess, weaponizing these people to try and destabilize Poland and perhaps force Polish border guards to react with force that then maybe can be exploited for propaganda, or it's hard to say what his exact aim is in this situation.
Right. And we should note that Belarus obviously is a landlocked country, and there are other countries experiencing these same issues at their borders, being Latvia and Lithuania in particular. But it's Poland that's on the receiving end of a lot of ridicule because they are defying international law by pushing these migrants back into Belarus and dispatching military troops along the border there, something that you don't see in Lithuania and Latvia. Now, Poland's saying that it may be against international law, but not against their own domestic laws. I want to play sound from you from the Polish foreign minister on his thoughts about who is at fault here.
The migrants are not only from Afghanistan, they are mostly from Iraq. There are people encouraged by the Belarusian regime to come to Minsk. They got the visa, they got the in a state-owned hotel's accommodation, they got the transportation towards the border with the EU, and they got the promise to do it illegally. And what's even worse, they paid a lot of money for that to the Belarusian regime.
We should know that that is the deputy foreign minister of Poland. Is he making a credible argument here? And is there too much ire being directed at Poland? Because this is coming at a time when they are experiencing their own tensions with the EU over their increase in nationalism with their latest elected government.
My sense is the Polish government is definitely pandering to public sentiment. Poland is a very divided country ever since the right-wing Law and Justice Party was elected into government in 2015. And the Polish government has taken a very hard line on this migrant issue. It's portraying its use of troops on the border and its lockdown in the border area. And indeed, it's very kind of real intransigence in terms of stopping these migrants or trying to stop these migrants from entering Poland as a kind of way of defending Poland from what senior officials have described as men with terrorist inclinations and even kind of lewd sexual inclinations. There's been a lot of disinformation by the Polish government, but Poland has definitely kind of chosen to push this very hard line that we are defending the country from dangerous individuals. Whereas liberals in Poland have staged protests against this narrative. And there are many activists who are working in the east of the country, some of whom have moved from European Union countries specifically to help migrants on the border. And I think they're very much motivated, based on my conversations with them, with a sense that their government is not doing right by these people who are, many of whom are trying to definitely seek a better life in Europe.
Yeah, there are some inspiring stories of just average citizens there in Poland trying to be a good citizen and help these migrants any way they can. In terms of what happens next, we know that Lukashenko has spoken with his benefactor, and that is Russian President Vladimir Putin, on this issue. Is there any sense, in your opinion, that this is going to take Russia's involvement to get some sort of resolution? Because you keep seeing this volleying back and forth of, you know, threats of more sanctions, and Lukashenko isn't really changing his actions at this point.
That's a very good question, and obviously these things are very hard to predict. But we did see last August, after Lukashenko's re-election as president, which the European Union and most Western countries have not accepted, we saw that Russia took a kind of backwards stance. It didn't make any major statements initially. It kind of waited, I think, the Kremlin to see how things will unfold. And I think we're kind of seeing a repeat of that at the moment. And I think Putin, as we know, based on his 21 or more years in power, he definitely likes to play this role of an international mediator in major crises. And so I think perhaps the Kremlin will definitely see this as an opportunity for Putin to play his role as, international statesman. And obviously they very ardently back the Lukashenko regime in Belarus. So this might be a good opportunity for them to play this role of the arbiters in this conflict, which, has definitely been of Belarus's making in large part, I think.
I guess I want to end by asking you just personally what this experience has been like and your takeaway from meeting families and individuals like Rocky. Is your sense of this crisis on the ground there, has it changed at all, just having a taste of what these families are going through?
I tried to take this story of this family because there was a lot of reporting on the kind of geopolitical dimension of this conflict, the countries involved and the senior officials and the statements they're making. And this particular story, I was very lucky, I think, to meet Raki and kind of have this, be with him during this experience. And it definitely made me realize that, perhaps, I guess, there isn't enough coverage of the fact that these are individuals, each of which has a very, very different story and very different reasons for making this very dangerous trek to Europe. And so I guess I'm not sure if how directly I'm answering your question, but, I definitely felt that this story kind of gave that particular angle on the situation. And perhaps there should be kind of more understanding of the fact that, there are very many different people in this group of, hundreds of migrants who are heading to the border, and they will be in far more difficult conditions once temperatures drop in coming weeks.
Well, unfortunately, not many reporters get access the way you did, and it is so important that you tell these stories, and we are fortunate to have you join us to tell them as well. Matthew, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Europe is currently battling another crisis, a spike in COVID cases, a surge that once again puts it at the epicenter of the pandemic. That's according to the WHO. It's particularly bad in some Eastern European countries where vaccine take-up is lower. Meanwhile, in the United States, the First Lady Jill Biden has kicked off a campaign to get kids vaccinated. My next guest is following all of these developments very closely. Dr. Paul Offit also has a new book out. I don't know when you have the time, but it is called You Bet Your Life, and it traces the history of risk in medicine. He's also the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit, thank you for joining us. And I mean it when I say I don't know when you have the time, but because between your important work and your important work coming on air with us to talk about COVID over these past few months, it is really impressive that you've been able to write an important book. As a pediatrician, let me begin with you. We are just a few days into kids ages 5 to 11, mine included. By the way, they got vaccinated on Friday, being eligible to receive the vaccine. How do you view, how would you assess the rollout thus far?
Well, I think we're getting there. If the 5 to 11-year-old accounts for about 28 million people in the United States, that's a little less than 10% of the population. Certainly, if all could be vaccinated, that would definitely help not only those children, but help decrease the spread of this virus in this country on the way to herd immunity. So I think it's a really important step. We need to protect our children, especially now. I mean, you're heading into the winter. You've got a fully susceptible group that are 5 to 11 years of age. Certainly, in communities where spread is still occurring, they need to be protected, and masks only do so much. This is the best way to protect our children.
Right. And look, anecdotally speaking, and I'm sure you hear the same, there are still many parents themselves who are vaccinated. They are not in this anti-vax movement. They follow the data, but they, just as parents, are having some reservations about their kids being vaccinated so early in. What is your message to them? And perhaps some of them are your patients as well.
Right, so the question is never, when do you know everything? You never know everything. The question is, when do you know enough? Do you know enough to move forward on vaccines for children? So what do you know? You know that for the 5 to 11-year-old, there's been about 2 million cases in that age group. You know that there's been about 8,300 hospitalizations, a third of which end up in the intensive care unit. And a third of those children had no predisposing risk factors that would have put them at high risk of serious disease. And you know more than 100 children have died. You know that a study was done of about 2,400 children showing the vaccine was 91% effective. And you know that as far as what everybody is most concerned about, this fear of myocarditis, you know, the heart muscle inflammation, mm-hmm. that there was less of a problem in the 12 to 15-year-old, and that this group, the 5 to 11-year-old, is even getting a smaller dose. So is that enough? I mean, I can tell you of the 18 people that voted on that for their FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, pretty much everybody voted yes. It was 17 to no, nothing to one abstention. And those 17 people would have never voted yes unless they would be willing to give that vaccine to their own children. I can tell you, where are my children 5 to 11 years of age now, I would give them that vaccine in a second, because there are no risk-free choices. There's just choices to take a different risk. And doing nothing is doing something. It's a choice to take that different risk.
And risk-taking is part of the thesis of your book, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But I know it's difficult for you, because it is for journalists as well, sort of juggling the legitimate questions and concerns that many have with just the plain and simple misinformation that's out there. And the Kaiser Family Foundation poll, I want to read this to you, asked participants about several false statements in regards to COVID-19. 78% of adults said they believe at least one of those statements to be true. How do you account for that, and how do you combat that successfully?
Well, the only thing you have on your side is science, reason, and data. And so if people, for example, think that the vaccine is dangerous in pregnancy, or they think that it causes infertility, or they think that it alters your DNA, you can argue that with science and reason and logic. You can. But for people who reach their conclusion without using reason or logic, you know, reason or logic isn't going to talk them out of it. I would say most people who have these concerns can be reassured, but there are certain groups who just are, you know, they're just not going to be convinced. They don't trust the government, they don't trust the industry, they don't trust the medical community, and they're just not going to be convinced.
We have seen some good signs, right? That COVID cases have plateaued, they've gone down in the country, but I was a bit baffled by a new Axios poll that's out, Axios Ipsos poll, and suggests Americans feel that COVID is much less of a risk. In fact, 55% of those polled said that they believe that the tide has turned, the corner has turned, and they think returning to a pre-COVID lifestyle poses little or no risk. I would imagine you would say it's too early to say that, but is it worrisome to hear this?
Well, we've said it before. I mean, there's been times in the past as we moved from sort of February to March to April of this past year where the numbers were coming down and everybody felt great as we headed into the summer months. This is at its heart a winter virus. And I think that as we head into winter, and you know that there are still certainly pockets in this country that are undervaccinated and groups like children less than 12 years of age who are unvaccinated or undervaccinated, even the 12 to 15-year-old is relatively unvaccinated. Only about 45% of those children have gotten a vaccine. I think it is too early to declare victory. I mean, if you could tell me for certain that a month from now these numbers are going to continue to go down, I would feel better. But I think nobody knows that, and I think you would be falsely reassured heading into the winter. If we were heading into June, July now, I would feel differently, but that's not it. We're heading into November, December, January, February, and I think that we will likely see a bump in cases. That's the most likely scenario.
Look, it's understandable that there is a lot of COVID fatigue in the nation. I feel it too at times. But as you said, we're only getting into colder weather months, right? And people are moving indoors as opposed to being outside. In terms of risks that people are willing to take, that's sort of the focus of your book, You Bet Your Life. And you talk about throughout history, the medical advancements in science and technology that we've seen to help keep people alive do come with a lot of risks. And in fact, there's nothing that's risk-free. It's a fascinating topic and an important one. But I'm wondering, just if, given what has been going on over the past nearly 2 years since we've been covering COVID, all of the misinformation, everything on social media, did you have any reservations about writing this book that basically suggests that nothing is completely a safe bet?
Not at all. Quite the opposite. I think what I'm trying to do in this book is to get people to understand that we learn as we go, that there's always a learning curve. And people will say, you know, well, let's just wait till the learning curve is over and then I'll try this medical innovation. The learning curve is never over. I think that for me, sort of the emotional part of this book would be that when we as the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee were asked, for example, to approve the vaccine for the 12 to 15-year-old, that was based on a study of about 2,300 children. There were 18 cases of COVID, all in the placebo group. And I got a lot of emails from parents, some of them more angry than others, that all said pretty much the same thing. 2,300 children? Really? That's all you want to test? Here you had Pfizer had done a trial of more than 40,000 adults, and now we're asked to vaccinate the 12 to 15-year-old with only a study of 2,400 children, where there were 18 cases of COVID, and to which my response is, okay, we could do 24,000 children, in which case there wouldn't be 18 cases of COVID, there would be 180 cases of COVID. And what that reminded me of was the polio vaccine. Back in the mid-1950s, when Jonas Salk made his polio vaccine, took polio, grew it up, purified it, gave it to about 700 children in the Pittsburgh area. It was safe, induced a great immune response, and he said to his wife, Donna, Eureka, I've got it. And then we proceeded to do a trial he didn't want to do. It broke his heart. So what happened between 1954 and 1955 is that we gave the vaccine to 420,000 children, gave a placebo to 200,000 children. He couldn't conscience giving a placebo vaccine to children knowing there was going to be polio in this country. So so when we declared that vaccine safe, potent, and effective, how do we know it was effective? We knew it was effective because 16 children died of polio in that study, all in the placebo group. We knew it was effective because 36 children were paralyzed in that study, 34 in the placebo group. I mean, I was a first and second grader in the 1950s. These children could have lived a long and fulfilling life, but for the flip of a coin. I think part of this book is about what human price are we willing to pay for knowledge, and when do we know enough?
You were one of the co-inventors, the rotavirus vaccine. So this is a personal experience for you as well, that you're reliving once again, dealing now with COVID-19. And I guess the question to you is, when do you ever stop worrying, given your past experience about, look, a successful phase 3 trial, right? But that's maybe 70,000, not 70 million, as I've read you say in an interview. So do you ever have that moment where you're finally saying, I don't have to stress about this, or is it always inside of you?
always inside of me. I mean, you know, when we did 70,000 person baby trial, right? It's a vaccine given by mouth to babies at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. 35,000 got vaccine, 35,000 got placebo, and the vaccine was safe and it worked. But you're right, 70,000 isn't 70 million or 700 million. I mean, this vaccine is now out in the world. And when do you stop worrying? You never stop worrying, because you know historically the learning curve pretty much never ends and that there's always surprises. And that's why if you learn anything in this business about medical innovation, it is humility, because you have to always keep your eyes open. Nobody would have ever imagined that mRNA vaccines would have caused myocarditis, this heart muscle inflammation. And nobody would have ever imagined that the vectored virus vaccines like the J&J vaccine or the AstraZeneca vaccine would cause a severe clotting problem. Rare, but real. But history teaches us that that's invariably true, that there is a human price for knowledge, and that's always the case.
And the human price, even if it initially begins in failure, is to always continue to learn and improve, because ultimately, as you explain in this book, millions of lives are changed and saved. Dr. Paul Offit, thank you so much for joining us. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Well, next, an unbearable tragedy. Eight families are searching for answers after their loved ones were killed in a crowd surge at the AstroWorld Music Festival in Houston. Victims aged between 14 and 27. Dozens were injured. Three remain in hospital. Rapper Travis Scott, who was performing at the time along with the organizers Live Nation, are under intense scrutiny over how this tragedy played out. On social media, Scott said he was devastated by what took place, while his partner Kylie Jenner said they were not aware of any fatalities until after the show. At least 18 lawsuits have been filed. Fans caught up in the crush have described their own panic.
It was traumatizing. I've never been in such chaos, like so unorganized, and just so many people like slamming into me. Like there was, it was really hell. It was really hell.
Someone passed out behind us before even Travis got on stage, before anything started. Everyone around me was screaming medic and trying to get them through, but we were so compact. There was not any room for anyone to get through.
It was so hard to move your arms, and like it was so hard to breathe that I was pushing whoever in front of me just like to get a breathe, just breathe.
Right before I passed out, I tried to turn my head to tell my boyfriend. I couldn't turn my head, but I tried to tell him I really was going to have him tell my son that I loved him, because I honestly did not think I was going to make it out of there. I'm not trying to be dramatic. I straight up thought I was going to die.
Joining me now is Chris Richards, a pop music critic for The Washington Post. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. And I have to say, you know, a few days into this tragedy, and it's still shocking to hear the reports from those who were there, some 50,000 people. Now, this is an event that had been put off for a couple of years because of COVID. So you can imagine just the enthusiasm and excitement that perhaps led to the devastation that unfolded. But can you really set the scene for what took place and how this possibly could have happened?
Well, it's very difficult to do that, having not been there, and also having spent my life in crowds of this size and never having experienced something like this. Music festivals of this nature and this size, this magnitude, take place all over the planet all the time, and very rarely do they tip over past this tipping point that we saw on Friday night. And for me, it's just been a lot of sort of mysterious searching of like what happens in a crowd when suddenly a collective expression of joy turns deadly. People become so excited and so euphoric that they're no longer paying attention to one another and one another's safety. And digging into the reasons behind why that could have happened, it's going to take a long time.
Well, this was not an impromptu event, and it was at a well-established scene, right, that has housed events like this before. And what we seem to be hearing now is a lot of finger-pointing in defense of what, you know, whether it was the organizer itself, whether it was the Houston police. We do know that the police chief said he spoke with Travis Scott before the concert. But from everything that you've heard, I know you say you weren't there. Does something stand out to you as unusual?
I mean, the one X factor, of course, is what you mentioned before, the idea that all of these young people are coming out of the tedium of 19 months of quarantine and they're excited to be together. I've never been at a festival like that. I have been to other festivals of this size all across the country, different age groups, different styles of music. The one commonality I think you'll see at a large music festival like this is maybe what you might call a lack of hospitality on behalf of the promoters. A lot of the waiting areas at these festivals can feel like holding pens. Bottles of water can cost more than $5. The restroom facilities can be filthy. And I think a lot of people, young people, walk into these festivals, they don't feel that they're at all respected by the space. So there's no suggestion that they should, you know, respect one another or respect the space itself. So I think just at a baseline, the first thing that the concert promotion industry needs to do, especially Live Nation, who is the largest promoter of concerts on this planet, they need to begin to improve the infrastructure at these festivals, to put a little more care into it, to let people know what's responsible of them and what people owe each other when they get together in these massive, massive groups.
Well, again, Live Nation is a well-known promoter, and from what I've read, there are many that don't want to go on the record in assessing what went wrong because of the stature of this company and Live Nation. They have issued a statement saying that they are assisting in the investigation into what happened. Here's what they said via Twitter. Heartbroken for those lost and impacted at Astroworld last night. We will continue working to provide as much information and assistance as possible to the local authorities as they investigate the situation. As we said earlier, Travis Scott issued a statement and a video on Instagram acknowledging that seeing the crowd, the ambulance in the crowd, he just may have just been distracted and confused about what was going on. We do have some video of concert goers that were desperate to try to stop the show. A man and a woman were pleading with a cameraman to do something, saying that people were dying. I want to play that video for us right now.
That's okay, we'll see you real quick. Chase me, let's do it.
Okay, so I understand it's dark. There's a lot of lights on the stage. There's thousands of people there. And one could understand maybe Travis's argument that he was confused and he didn't know what was going on. But given sort of the circumstances leading up to big events like this, aren't there certain protocols? Is there no one that could talk to him in his earpiece the way my producers do in my earpiece to let them know that the show needs to be stopped, that there's an emergency out in the audience?
I would hope that would happen. And obviously, there's a lot of debate over whether, you know, is the security to blame for this? Is the artist have a responsibility in it? I will say, when you are in the noisy darkness of performance up on stage, and also as a rapper whose job it is to be able to recite thousands upon thousands of words over music, you know, you're focused on your performance. And I don't think it's fair for people to say that this one pair of eyeballs should have had his sort of watch over 50,000 people. Of course, there were hundreds and hundreds of security personnel on site whose job it is to be monitoring the safety of the situation. Should they be able to relay that information to the stage and get the concert to somehow slow down, calm down? That's what I'm sure we're going to be parsing for weeks ahead. I mean, people have said that there were some reports saying that promoters feared stopping the concert in fears that the audience would then riot and create more problems, more violence. So there's a lot of work to be done. And again, I think it does go back to companies like Live Nation, especially Live Nation, who promotes more than 100 festivals like this around the planet a year. They have the resources to begin to improve the situations at these kind of events, and it's going to be on them to do it.
I believe, Chris, that one of the reasons there's so much attention on Travis Scott himself and his behavior is because there's a past history with his behavior and sort of instigating some of this crowd rushing to various concerts that he's performed in the past. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. He does have a well-reported history of riling up the crowd, being an exciting performer. A lot of other artists also have this kind of history. Apparently, some of these incidents have gotten the law involved, though, at Travis Scott concerts. So one concert attendee fell off of a balcony at one of his shows and pursued legal action against him. I believe that he was arrested after speaking out against the security guards, maybe, at the Lollapalooza Festival a few years ago. So, of course, he has this track record. But again, I will say that music's job and the music that he makes, the job is to get the crowd excited and to feel togetherness and to feel a sense of release, if you will. And I'm not personally the kind of person who's ready to you know, point the finger at the artist immediately and say it's they're responsible for it. A lot of people shared videos this weekend of Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters, you know, in the past sort of calling out bad behavior in the audience. And I think it's important for people to remember Dave Grohl was playing to just a few thousand people indoors in those settings. It's a lot easier for him to see what's going on and to try and call it out. This festival was immense. We're talking about 50,000 people. It's very, very hard for one artist to kind of be keeping track of that. Yeah,
of course. We're not here to point fingers. We're here to sort of, you know, dig into why this tragedy happened, especially when you look at, you know, any death is a tragedy. But when you look at these ages, you know, a 9-year-old boy is now in a medically induced coma. This is not something that you would expect at a festival. And unfortunately, this isn't the first type of event, a music event. We've seen this happen at sports events in the past as well. In 1989, nearly 100 people died in a human crush at the Hillsborough Soccer Stadium. In 1979, 11 people died at the Who concert in Cincinnati, Ohio. What provisions can be taken and should be taken going into such a huge event, like 50,000 people turning out to see one person?
That's really hard for me to say. I do think the infrastructure at these events can be improved to just be thinking of themselves as more hospitable and offering hospitality to the attendees. That's one step. Another step comes from people realizing, young people realizing when they join a crowd, they're joining a communal event and they have a responsibility to one another in a sense. I think that's some conversation that we can facilitate in journalism. We can facilitate it between artists and their fans. It can be facilitated on social media. But when we go to a concert, we're not there to just be consumers. We're not there to just fork over our money and take in music. We're there to be together, to be with one another, and to watch out for one another. And again, I'm not blaming these young people who were caught in this incredibly, you know, difficult situation on Friday night for their behavior. It was a mass event where euphoria got out of control. And I don't know, you know, where that, again, where that tipping point is. But I do think some kind of public discussion about what we owe one another when we go into an event together in public is warranted and will take place now, the more we talk about
it. Yeah, and you allude to that when you write, mass gatherings are intrinsically fragile but relatively stable things. To join one requires a collective step toward the edge of control without stepping over it. Collective step being the important highlighter there. Chris Richards, thank you so much for coming on the program. We appreciate it. Well, turning now to one of the worst drug epidemics in American history.
If OxyContin does what I think it can, it could soon become Purdue's first billion-dollar drug.
Hulu's new scripted drama, Dopesick, explores how Purdue Pharma's highly addictive painkiller, OxyContin, led to a tragic ripple effect on communities throughout the country. Actors Peter Sarsgaard and John Hogenacker join Hari Srinivasan to discuss their roles in the project and the urgency of the opioid crisis.
Bianna, thanks. Peter Sarsgaard, John Hogenacker, thanks for joining us. First, I want to ask both of you, when you were looking through the script, when you were preparing for this, well, what surprised you? Peter, let me start with you.
Oh, you know, I think it was this campaign by Purdue Pharma to really make the people who became addicted seem like the problem, that they were kind of a small percentage of people who were prescribed the drug, that they were prone to it, that they were addicts, that they were less than. And I think that's also really what got me angry.
I would agree that all of that was concerted and that it was by design and that the idea at the end of the day was just to push opium on the masses, to try and find a way to beef that market up. And I was also disheartened that, you know, we like to put our faith in these governmental entities that are there to protect us. I was disheartened at the breakdown that happened at the governmental level, at the FDA, that allowed this to make it to market in the form that it made it to market.
We're going to roll in a clip, the young salesman talking to Michael Keaton's character for the first time, talking about that phrase, less than 1% addictive.
I've got another patient coming in here in a few minutes, so.
Of course, I won't take up much of your time. You're probably already familiar with our drug, MS-Cotton. Used to treat severe pain, mainly patients of cancer.
MS-Cotton is a very good drug.
So what Purdue did is they took the same system, the cotton system, and they produced an opioid for chronic and moderate pain.
I would never prescribe a narcotic for moderate pain. There's a pretty long history down here of pill abuse.
Less than 1% of people get addicted to OxyContin.
That's not possible.
But it is. The FDA actually created a special label to say that it's less addictive than other opioids. Right there.
Your most effective talking point is the FDA label. These are your new magic words. Delayed absorption as provided by OxyContin tablets.
Delayed absorption as provided by OxyContin tablets
is believed to reduce
the abuse liability of a drug.
I've never seen a label like this on a class 2 narcotic.
Peter, as you're reading through the script and you see the ways that the salespeople were, you know, working their doctors, trying to improve reach of the drug, it almost reads like fiction. Like you couldn't make this up. This is what was happening on a daily basis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the incentives put before them were ridiculous and obvious. And I think one of the things that I really came out of this thinking was that, you know, this really comes down to a fault in our healthcare system where you have so few people that have a primary care physician or a healer or whatever it is in your circle that is someone that they can rely on and trust, that the doctor, you know, is getting his ear pulled more by the salesperson and the government is protecting, you know, big pharma more than it is the individual. And at the consumer level, at the person who is in need, at the person who's in pain, you know, they're just being left out completely. So it really comes down to restoring that relationship between the physician and the patient and finding a place for it in our healthcare system.
Totally agree. And we're kind of in a perfect storm scenario, too, where doctors, I think, you know, generally are good people, principled people who are doing the best they can for all of their patients. But we're in a situation right now where your average doctor gets like, what, 12, 13 minutes with you when you come in for a checkup. It's not enough time for them. And I think most healthcare professionals would echo that. And then, you know, they are approached by these drug reps who hand them labels that have been approved by the FDA, and they have to take it at face value. They have to believe the tests that were submitted by Purdue Pharma to the FDA for the approval process. And again, that gets back to some of the things that just blew us away. I mean, as you read into this and you find terms like pseudo-addiction, when a patient who is dealing with actual addiction, they come up with a term that turns it into something a little bit warmer and fluffier. It can be dealt with more of the drug.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating to me is that we were in this climate where there was this national rethinking of pain. And it wasn't really until this series and a little bit of the other research that I'm realizing that wasn't by coincidence, that this whole thing was by design, that we were part of a campaign that we didn't realize we were part of that was actually serving an end goal.
Actually, you think about, you know, I think about as recently as last year, going into a hospital and seeing a pain chart, that pain chart that we all know with the faces and 1 through 10. Well, and a subsidiary of Purdue Pharma is responsible for making that pain chart to start the conversation, right? To make the conversation about pain. Well, pain is obviously something that none of us likes to deal with, but the primary conversation should be about what the illness is, what the problem is, and ways of going about fixing it. And dealing with pain is obviously a discussion you need to have, but it's not the first one.
I'd been living with pain for so long, but then almost overnight, I got my life back.
As shown in Exhibit 1A of the Got My Life Back promotional video, Purdue manipulated basic facts of the drug, claiming it is essentially non-addictive when it clearly was. And these participants involved were deceived into participating, being told it was a PSA for pain relief instead of an advertisement for OxyContin. And many of them are now addicted or dead from drug use. So we request access to all internal marketing materials, research, and testing data to determine if there are other deceptions as flagrant as the exhibit currently before the court.
Your Honor, statements made by counsel in no way even resemble the facts. My client is aware there have been addiction issues in this part of the world, but blaming Purdue Pharma for this is like blaming Budweiser for a drunk driver. It is the fault of the drug abuser and not of the manufacturer. The scope of the subpoena is overly broad, and the information contained in their request is privileged.
Your Honor, if there is no liability,
what these local lawyers don't seem to understand is that there is a national pain movement that is far bigger than my client and its drugs. Renowned pain organizations have not only endorsed my client's medication, but the general use of increased opioid treatment. My client should be given a Nobel Prize, not a subpoena for materials.
What's interesting in this clip and so many others is how completely outgunned the government resources are in this situation. I mean, you literally see almost a phalanx of lawyers lining up for the pharma company. And, you know, you and John's character seem like, you know, Boy Scouts and Mr. Smith goes to Washington compared to what's happening.
Well, there's that. There's the, you know, enormous wealth of the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma. There's also the fact that the amount of lobbying that they had done in Washington, D.C. So they've essentially got lawmakers behind them, you know. It really is a David and Goliath story. And, you know, I didn't actually talk to Rick Mountcastle until after we did the film. But it really is incredible what they did, and incredible that they believed that they could do it. You know, I mean, it's really a spectacular story. It's one of the things that really drew me to it. I rarely get the opportunity to play someone that I'm so in thrall of.
Yeah, it was audacious, even the attempt. I mean, given the Sacklers' records of fending off prior attempts, I think
60 suits prior, something like that. Yeah.
I mean, also a bit revelatory in watching this show is the sort of critical eye placed on the FDA. And on the one hand, you can say how absolutely under-resourced they are. And then on the other hand, you also look at the system structurally. It seems aligned so that the very companies that they are regulating have different hands in creating the rules that are regulating them.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I want to echo something that you just intimated, which is I believe that the FDA is made up of good, well-intentioned, principled individuals. But then when you get an organism that can be this ungainly, it is possible for it to be misused. And we as individuals, I mean, it harkens back to the sort of lobbying paradigm that we have in Congress, that you can come in, you can make a lot of friends, a lot of connections, you can serve one term, and then you can still make a really good income for yourself for the rest of your working days. And the same can be true of the FDA. If you leave and you know how the approval process works, you can shepherd companies that just want to bring drugs to market through that process.
That happened with Purdue. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact,
it was even perhaps a little more questionable than that. If it happened the way that it looks like it happened, an FDA person who worked at the FDA huddled with people from Purdue. And I don't want to give too much away in the story for people who haven't seen it. But yeah, it is. There is a lot of kind of backroom dealing that can happen.
I want to take a look at another clip here because the real tragedy is the ripple effects that it has on any community that is impacted by this.
Going after a publicly traded company is a pretty steep hill to climb.
They're not publicly traded. It's privately owned by a single family, a Sackler family.
Sacklers? They're big philanthropists, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they give lots of money to museums and schools. Rich person stuff.
Very rich.
So what do you guys got that no other U.S. attorney in the country is onto?
Well, about 4 months ago, I was reviewing our caseload when I noticed an unusual pattern. Almost every case over the last 3 years was related to OxyContin. Nearly everyone. Illegal drug sales, theft, armed robbery, child abandonment.
I mean, it has transformed the entire district. Jails are suddenly full. Violent crime is running rampant. For the last 200 years, folks around here didn't even lock their doors. Didn't even think about it. Now, starting 3 years ago,
everyone locks their doors.
It's the single highest source of crime in the entire region.
You know, what was interesting to me is that when you look at the statistics of what has happened to the United States because of the overdoses, 500,000 people have died. And in any other reality, that number, you would think, would move us toward action. Peter, have you been following what's been happening in the case and how this has been progressing?
Well, yeah, I mean, there has been some progress in the case. with Purdue. You know, there was a settlement for, John, correct me if I'm wrong, $4.5 billion, something like that.
That's,
you know,
right. But, paid over 9 years.
You know, I have someone very close to me who became addicted. And so I did this documentary in 2016 where I went to Dayton, Ohio, and Shonda Rhimes and Norman Lear produced it. And I just had like a real need to tell the true story. The kind of ripple effect of death and poverty and sadness caused by this drug is absolutely massive. I saw a jail cell filled because in Dayton, they had this policy of taking someone, you know, who's in possession and putting them in a jail cell. I believe it was for 30 days, kind of enough time for them to just barely dry out. And I saw a jail cell for young women, and it was filled with probably, just on a random day, I went there, I think, with about 70 young girls. And that is the thing that I really want people to take away is, yeah, this is about the Sacklers. This is about, you know, lobbyists and government. But this is really about the individual and the families and the children that have been affected by this drug, not just the deaths.
What do you both think it will take for America to pay attention to this? I mean, we've had this slow-rolling tragedy for a few years now, and there have been books about this. There have been documentaries. There's this series that you're both part of. What do you think keeps Americans from paying the necessary amount of attention? Is it where it's happening? Is it who it's happening to? I mean,
I've been talking to my son, who's 12 years old, about how this drug and opioids in general can rewire the brain. There's an arc of a character in the show who falls prey to addiction, and then she looks like she's getting clean, and then other things happen, and he doesn't understand how, after she's gotten clean, it could happen again. And I think that what we're really, really going for is to put a little bit more empathy into the conversation around addiction that people deal with in this country. We have to start to see people who are dealing with addiction in a more empathetic way. You know, the greater conversation about pain being part of the healing process, that's a really huge mountain to climb, and I have no idea how we get there, but I think that's part of it too.
Peter, I wonder also, you had mentioned that this had personally affected you, and I want to know whether that guided how you played this character or how you dedicated yourself to this role.
It's the reason I am interested in doing it. You know, I mean, the turmoil that it causes within a family. And I, you know, I come from a family where myself and a few others of us have the means to, you know, help someone through this, because if you want to try to get through it, it's a very expensive proposition, and your insurance really isn't going to cover it if you have insurance. So that personal connection to it is the drive for me. It makes it possible to play a character who, like, in every scene, I am single-minded about my purpose, you know, to the detriment of probably my own family at certain points. But, like, this is a man on a mission. And, you know, there are lots of causes. There's lots of things to worry about and talk about in this world. But this one is so, it's, to me, it is so preventable, just because if the government got on the side of the individual instead of the corporation, instead of the pharmaceutical company, and they passed the Sackler Act, then when they actually put individuals, executives in jail, instead of just fining them, because these are just parking tickets. They sound like big numbers to us, but these are parking tickets. That, I think, will start to put a dent into it. But it's a matter of the government protecting us, you know?
You know, John, I wonder, this is a spoiler alert for the audience, but when you figured out that the person at the FDA who helped write the rules for how OxyContin could be distributed went to work for Purdue Pharma afterward, what went through your mind?
we have to, as best as we can, we have to keep stories like this alive, not just instances like the one you mentioned, Harry, but stories like how the opioid crisis came to be in this country. We have to demonstrate that it's important to us, and we have to push lawmakers to pass things like the Sackler Act. I looked it up this morning, and it's stuck. It's bouncing around in subcommittees. It's currently in the Antitrust, Commercial, and Administrative Law Subcommittee. They're just passing it around. Oh, I think it looks good, but I don't know. Why don't you have a look at it? Oh, I think it looks good, but I don't know. Why don't you? And then, you know, another election happens, the country moves in a different direction, and maybe nothing happens. And this is how it goes on and on and on. But we cannot become complacent. It's very important that when we are given the opportunity to vote, that we get out and make it happen.
The series is on Hulu. It's called Dope Sick. Peter Sarsgaard, John Hookenecker, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And just a note, last November, Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty to 3 felony offenses. The Sackler family does not currently face any criminal charges, and no member of the family have been convicted of a crime for actions related to Purdue Pharma, nor do they admit wrongdoing. In August, during bankruptcy proceedings, former company president Richard Sackler said he believes his family and the OxyContin manufacturer bear no responsibility for the opioid crisis. And finally, forget fry-ups and Bloody Marys. Could this amethyst ring cure a hangover? Well, archaeologists say it may have been worn all the way back in the 7th century to try to do just that. The jewel has been discovered after the excavation of this huge ancient wine factory in Israel. It was found lying just 500 feet away from a warehouse holding ancient jars used to store wine. It makes sense. Well, archaeologists say amethyst was believed to have had many virtues thousands of years ago, the prevention of the side effect of drinking being just one of them. It's fascinating. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.